Tracy Walker can't be with us, but Trevor Benjamin can, which is great. So here we are, Trevor and Tracy. Wait, that can't be right.
All right, so first of all, thank you to the organizers. CA Day, in its fifth year, it's a fantastic event, so please keep it up. So my talk connects with the last talk in a lot of ways. First of all, it's not on institutional data, it's everyday conversations. Second, it is some collaborative work, but as Charles already mentioned. Unfortunately, Tracy won't be here. So this automatically introduces a bit of an asymmetry here, in the sense that I'm going to be animating the talk, but she's very much a principal of it. So if you don't like what you hear, please email her with your... So we're interested in a situation which I think we all have quite a bit of experience with, which is where someone has said or done something which you think is wrong. And we're looking at a practice which people have for addressing this incongruity, we're calling it. So, I mean, the idea is that something that you know or believe or feel or have an attitude towards differs from evidently what this person has just shown you. And just a bit of terminological stuff here. So wrong, we're talking about wrong in the broader sense, so not just the accuracy, you know, the truth, the veracity, but also issues of the appropriateness of what's said, but also the appropriateness of its design. This will all become clear as we get to the example. Second, think. This is the gloss just for a wide range of epistemic positions. So the situations where it's a niggling doubt, I don't think that's right, all the way up to that's dead wrong. And finally, of course, we're talking here about social claims being made, epistemic positions, epistemic stances being displayed, not necessarily what you really mean. Okay, so again, we're calling this incongruity. So, what can you do when someone has said something wrong? The first thing you can do is you can let it go. You can just ignore this incongruity and move on with things. And I think you've all maybe just done this. Did anyone notice that I spelled the dress wrong? Did anyone notice that?
No.
Oh, shit. Oh, yes, thank you. All right, good. I was hoping. So, yes, you've done it. So which is good, because that is, in most situations, the, of course, preferred course of action. It lets me get on with what I'm doing. It gives me opportunities to fix the problem myself. And this is really nicely captured in this lovely little exchange that Gail Jefferson talked about in a paper on this. And so when someone says something wrong and another person lets it go, you sometimes get this little exchange. Why didn't you tell me? I knew what you meant. And so what B is getting at here is that if you're in a position to notice something wrong, then you've clearly heard and understood and got some sense of what has been done. And if that's the case, then why bother addressing it at all? And there's probably a bit more opaque but more technical description from the repair paper, which is, when the hearing or understanding of a turn is adequate to the production of a correction by other, it's adequate to allow production of a sequentially appropriate next turn. Under that circumstance, the turn's recipient, the other, should produce the next turn, not the correction. And overwhelmingly, that's what's done. So there's a few bases for letting these things go. But there's another one, and that is, it allows you to avoid that morally and socially messy situation of calling someone else's conduct into question and challenging their competency. So we're going to say that. So often you can let these things go. You probably should let these things go. But there are situations where you can't or you don't want to. How do you address it? Okay, so I'm going to be talking specifically about those situations where you halt progressivity and initiate repair on this problematic item, okay? There's lots of ways to do it on the sly, embeddedly, but this is what we're talking about. So if you look at the literature, there seems to be two major strategies that people have. And the first one is to just reject it and offer a correction right off the bat. And there's some, Gail Jefferson talked a lot about these. And the other option is a more sly way of doing it. And that's to initiate repair, but to sort of mask the type of trouble. So you treat it as possibly a hearing problem or an understanding problem. I didn't quite get what you're saying. So that allows the speaker to repair this thing themselves, to fix the inappropriacy, without you having to actually gone on the record as having said that was wrong. And there's probably Svenvik's paper from 2009 is the most extensive investigation into this sort of way of dealing with this problem. Now, what Tracy and I are looking at is something that seems to be somewhere in between, option 1.5. It seems to be, so what the practice that we're looking at is repeating the problematic item, okay? But specifically through the phonetic design of this practice, we're arguing that this communicates explicitly that that is this type of problem. It's not a hearing problem, it's not an understanding problem, it's one of those other types. So something that you've said is inappropriate or wrong in some way. So this is, just to make clear, there's been loads of literature on the use of repeats to initiate repair, of course. Starting all the way back from Jefferson's stuff, her first paper. And lots of people have recognized that, yes, when you repeat what someone said, sometimes the problem is what they don't like what you've said, it's wrong in some way. But we think this is the first time that someone has made the claim that a particular practice of repeating is doing this specifically. Okay, so it's not, it doesn't seem to allow that sly sort of, it could be another type of problem. Okay, so what's the practice? Let's hope we can hear this. Nope.
Is that in?
It's in. Maybe an in wrong one.
Who directed it?
There we go. Okay. So for the first one, I just want you to listen to these things. Okay. We'll go into the sequential analysis in a minute.
Who directed it?
James Cameron.
Okay.
And then there's a French guy, Dominique.
A French guy.
And.
What's new?
Okay. So, what we've got is a repetition. You repeat something or all of what someone has just said. But specifically, you do it with this type
James Cameron.
What's new? A French guy.
Mr.
Badman.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so I mean, there's quite a bit of variability, and this isn't a phonetics talk, but there is quite a bit of variability there. But there are some core similarities, and it's not just for the sake of comparison. These are I'm going to play a few other collections, which are also repeats, but they sound different.
You have no time.
1, 1, 2.
It's reading those 2.
Okay, so the point is that we're arguing that phonetics is playing a constitutive role here. So part of what this practice is in the phonetics. So it's not just it's a repeat, it's a repeat of these phonetics. So there's some other people, of course, who've argued that if you want to study repeats or many other types of practices, then the phonetics are an important part. Okay, so what is the action? So we're saying that when you do one of these repetitions, you're claiming an incongruity between this, what I'm repeating, and what I know or think or believe to be right, appropriate, or acceptable. And it's launching a sequence for addressing it. Now, the few cases I'm going to play you now are meant to illustrate some of the variety in both of these parts. So, in the James Cameron case, you're going to see that the issue is the veracity of talk. B is saying he didn't direct the movie. But in the case of a French guy, the issue isn't, I doubt what you're saying, it's, I don't like it. So it's the appropriacy or the acceptability of that described conduct. And in the what's new, the issue isn't about the content at all. It's about, you've designed this action inappropriately for me in this context. Now, the second issue is that these all are launching a sequence for addressing this. They're initiating a repair sequence. But there's, again, quite a bit of variability in the type of sequence. So in James Cameron, the person, as you'll see, backs down immediately. They show clear orientation to this. But in other cases, you get different types of sequential trajectories, and we'll go through those now. Okay, so the first extract is James Cameron. So the participants are talking about the movie Crash, and so A has just seen this, and as this extract opens, B asks her who directed it. Okay, she offers James Cameron as an answer, and then you get a repetition of James Cameron. Now, as you're going to see, this isn't saying, what did you say, James Cameron? Is that what you said, James Cameron? It's not saying, James Cameron, who's James Cameron? It's saying, that's not who directed it. So it's challenging the veracity of all this evidence. And for the record, as you can see here, David Cronenberg directed the film. It wasn't James Cameron. But neither of the participants know, or at least in any way claim to know who it is. It's just that James Cameron wasn't.
Who directed it?
James Cameron.
James Cameron?
I think
that
can't be.
No, he's an action movie.
Well, this was action. It was cow smashes every 2 minutes.
He kind of normally does films that you don't have to think about.
Somebody we want to see anyway directed it.
Okay, I'm going to do something embarrassing and ask if you notice where I put my notes. Well, I've got this, but I had some notes.
You may have given them away with all of your transcripts.
I may well have.
There's something looking like notes.
Yeah. Someone gets the cheat sheet then. All right.
Oh,
so
look, this is a manuscript. Okay, I could run away with this and publish it myself. Oh,
okay. Okay, so, I should have just gone off card. But, so, what you see is in response to the James Cameron, A, first epistemically downgrades, I think, and then flat out rejects their answer. No, it can't be. Finally, she checks if she even has the right person in mind. He did Titanic, didn't he? So each of these actions are consistent with her seeing this repetition as challenging the veracity of this answer. And we get further evidence when we look at what B does next. So first with no, she aligns with A's retraction of the answer. And then with he's an action movie, which she doesn't finish, she provides the grounds for her challenge. Based on what she knows or expects from James Cameron, this film, which the participants earlier described as film noir and smutty porn, isn't the type of film that James Cameron would direct. Okay, so there's these two things are incongruent. It doesn't match up. Now, so the point is that with the repetition, James Cameron, B has marked out an incongruity between what A has just said and what she, her own knowledge or beliefs about the issue. And then she has launched a sequence for attending to it. Okay, now, like many of the cases in our collection, speaker A doesn't let the issue go easily. So they work to make their offending talk accountable, even in cases like this, where she even herself pulls back and retracts her answer. She still works to make it accountable. So first when she says, well, this wasn't action, there was car crashes every 2 minutes. She's arguing that the movie was in some way consistent with her description of James Cameron being an actor. And even when she moves to close the sequence, she maintains some semblance of the appropriacy of her answer. So she says, somebody beginning with C, anyway, directed. So her answer, while mistaken, admittedly, is understandable. It was sort of an action movie, and she wasn't totally wrong. She at least got the first letter right. Okay, some car crashes. Okay. So the point is that across the collection, we often get long, extended sequences of arguments, counter-arguments, accounts, and the like. And this makes them, again, quite different from your typical repair sequence with, you know, James Cameron, confirmation, progression. 5 minutes. Okay. Quickly onto the second case. So the second one, a French guy. So like James Cameron, this repetition marks out an incongruity. And it launches a sequence for addressing it. However, it differs in two ways. First, the incongruity is of a different type. Rather than it challenging the truth, it's challenging the appropriacy or acceptability. B doesn't doubt it, he just doesn't like it. Second, speaker B here responds minimally with a yeah, so they don't back down. But in both A and B's subsequent talk, we see clear orientation to the challenge embodied in the repeat. So speaker A's yeah here can be hearable as standing firm, as maintaining her position in the facial challenge. Okay, so before I play the extract, there's a bit of ethnographic detail that seems relevant here. First, B is female and A is male. Second, they're in their late teens. They're in their university. And finally, they both have a Hispanic American background, and throughout the conversation, they've oriented to the fact that they're Latin in lots of different ways. Okay, so as the extract opens, A is describing the people that she's going to be living with the following year. I'm going to start at line 6. But as you can see from the highlighted sections earlier on, up to this point, A has been describing this as a house of girls, Okay, she'll be living with girls, the first girl, the second girl, this sort of thing. Okay, so let's have a listen.
American who was raised in Germany, who's for the first time been in the States, mm-hmm. and then there's a French guy, Dominique.
A French guy?
Yeah.
You're having a guy in your girl house?
We have two guys. We need guys. We would never live in a house alone. Okay, that's Latin, no?
That's what?
That's Latin.
Well, I don't know if it's Latin or not.
Okay, so with his repetition, a French guy, B claims that something that A has said about this person is in some way incongruent with his knowledge or beliefs or attitudes. Plus, the speaker uses prosodic prominence to locate more precisely what about this person is problematic. So by accenting guy, he selects specifically the person's gender as problematic. Compare this with a French guy, which would instead locate the person's nationality or background. Okay? So what's B's problem, and how does A deal with it? To begin, A simply confirms, yeah, it's a French guy that she'll be living with. If the problem were one of hearing or perhaps understanding, this might be sufficient. But we see that B doesn't accept this treatment and pushes on. So he says, you're having a guy in your girl house? So this spells out more explicitly the incongruity. What he's claiming is that it's problematic that he's a guy because it's a girl house. Now, he doesn't explicitly, or at least lexically, claim that this state of affairs is inappropriate or unacceptable. So he spells out what's the incongruity, but not why it's problematic. He doesn't say something like, you shouldn't do that, or you can't do that, or does your mom know? He doesn't do something like that. But we see from A's subsequent response that that's how it's treated. She defends the described conduct. First, accounting for it as a matter of safety. We need guys, we'd never live alone. And then on cultural grounds, that's Latin. Now, unfortunately, I don't have enough about this to know why being Latin could be an account for this, but it's constructed as one in any case. Okay, next, B's subsequent response provides further evidence. Okay, so first of all, B doesn't pull back and say, I wasn't criticizing, or I don't see any problem. So he implicitly aligns with this treatment by not initiating repair and pulling back. And more importantly, what he does do is he offers a sort of begrudging acquiescence. If that's the way it's going to go, that's the way it'll go, conveys that he's not happy about it. But since she's made up her mind, there's not much he can do. So, a French guy, like James Cameron, claims these repetitions, claim there's an incongruity, and it launches a sequence for addressing that. Now, how much time do I have? 1 minute. So I'm not going to show you the third case. I'll quickly pay it and let it speak for itself, which I know you're not supposed to do. No? Okay, I guess no. So, what are we arguing here? We're arguing that...
You didn't even do a repeat.
Flat out shut down. Okay. So the third case is essentially, it's again, marked incongruity. So the situation is the two people have never talked before. A girl calls her... A friend of hers gets put on the phone with the person's roommate. They end up having a little opening of a chat, and the person says, "What's new?" The guy goes, "What's new? We've never spoken before." That presupposes that. So he literally spells it out. But the point is that there, it's very much like the last talk. There you get the repetition plus account immediately, whereas in this case we saw this coming down later down the sequence. So you get different sequential trajectories. But in all of the cases in our collection, you get something which you get orientation from A or B or from both that the problem is one of this type. Okay? It's about there's some incongruity between what I know or believe or think and what you've just done. And that can be a problem with, you know, simple veracity, you've said something inaccurate. It can be a problem with, like in this case, where I don't disbelieve you, it's just I, for whatever reason, find this inappropriate or unacceptable. Or in the what's new case, it's just you've designed your action inappropriately for me in this context. Now I am going to quickly read a nice little Gail Jefferson quote. What's really neat about these is that, so, I mean, these types of resources are really important because they're one of the ways we have of if you're claiming something is wrong and working to make it right, it's one of the ways you have of patrolling and defending the knowledge and beliefs that you have about the world. And that's a pretty damn important thing to be able to do. But there's more to it than just making things right. So Gail Jefferson, when she looked at corrections, she found that the corrector and the correctee regularly become engaged in morally charged activities like complaining, admitting, apologizing, forgiving, accusing, ridiculing, justifying, defending. She has a long list. And this led her to conclude that the business of correcting, can be a matter not merely of putting things to right, but of specifically addressing lapses in competence and conduct. So while a flat-out correction and what we're looking at are clearly different practices with different trajectories, they seem to hold that in common, because we see the same type of morally charged work happening throughout these sequences. Okay, that's it.
Thank you very much. Right, some time left for chat and comments. Giovanni's up your hand incipiently up. Yeah. Off you go.
That's incipient, yeah.
Sorry, you might have said that at the beginning, but are you looking at only British data or
no, it's British and American. I didn't say anything about the data. So it's a bunch of informal conversations, mostly telephone calls, the standard CA corpus, and it's British and American. Okay.
So I was wondering, that might be more of a phonetic question.
Yeah.
If there are differences.
See, this is one of the great things of not having your co-presenter here. Well, Tracy would be able to tell you lots about that, but unfortunately, as far as I know, she hasn't found any differences between the two corpuses. Oh, silence, that's bad.
Now, I've spotted a couple of people. I want to see if others who haven't spoken yet would like to throw in a question or observation. I'll go to the old lags then. Neil, you
were first. I just wanted to ask you about the first one was the James Cameron.
Yeah.
And the work which the second, the part to that, the repeat of James Cameron. And you were saying the work that was doing was a denial of the first James Cameron.
Yes.
It seemed to me that the denial of that comes later, and that the first James Cameron, the second James Cameron, is actually an expression of a reality disjuncture for that recipient,
yeah.
Okay? And then when the first speaker then says, and takes it as, disjuncture, and then says, oh, well, and the hesitation, and then the denial comes in the next part after that.
Yeah. So the.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah,
I mean. the temporal unfolding. What we're arguing is that there is a two-partness to it. The first is that it's claiming or whatever. It's adopting the stance that there's some sort of incongruity or disjuncture or whatever you want to call it. But it is opening up a sequence for addressing that. And in all of the cases we have, 30 or whatever cases, I mean, they're not all so obvious. I mean, we've obviously shown some more clear-cut cases. But there is always work being done to set things right, or at least to point out that that's wrong. It doesn't always get resolved, of course, but it's the same old story. Like, whether the initial repetition is about getting in next position some back down, or if it's just about making the claim, I don't know if we can answer that. But certainly the issue gets addressed in the subsequent talk. And sometimes you get immediate moves to back down, sometimes you get immediate accounts. Whereas sometimes you get the simple confirmation, but if you get the simple confirmation, you always get a push from the original speaker, where they spell out why it's problematic, or they say that's ridiculous, or something, you know, something like that. So I don't know if that answered your question, but
okay. I think we'll have to stop there. Okay. Thank you again, Trevor.